From search and rescue in the rubble to recovery. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. More victims of the Champlain Towers South collapse have been found as investigations into what happened pick up. The catastrophe has impacted so many people in South Florida's condominium community. How could the tragedy change condo owner associations? One association under scrutiny is in North Miami Beach, where the Crestview Towers has been empty for a week over structural worries. The North Miami Beach mayor will be here this hour. And the middle-of-the-night assassination of Haiti's president in his home. Two men from South Florida are among those arrested. We'll have the latest. All ahead on the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN, made possible by Willie the Bee-Man, Bee Removal Specialist. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. The official death toll from the Champlain Towers South collapse keeps climbing today as the search and rescue officially ended earlier this week. It's been just over 2 weeks since part of the building fell in the middle of the night, killing dozens. Last weekend, the rest of the building that was left standing was demolished. As the recovery work of going through the rubble continues, so does the scrutiny of the building, its owners' association, engineering reports, building plans, inspections, and notices. Governor Ron DeSantis called condominium buildings like Champlain Towers South, quote, a dime a dozen in Florida.
I can just say, just having talked with people who've been on the scene, people who've done stuff, I think this building had problems from the start. Let's just put it that way.
The catastrophic collapse leads to lots of questions about the role of condominium boards, state and local regulators, and how to prevent anything like this from happening again. This is where we start this week here on the South Florida Roundup. We want to hear from you. Do you belong to a condominium owners association? Have you belonged to one of these groups in the past? Share that experience with us. Perhaps you rent an apartment in the condominium building. What's that experience like working with a landlord who may be part of a building's association? Here's the phone number for your input, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. You can also send us a tweet at WLRN. We particularly want to hear from renters and owners and members of owner associations and talk to us about what they have been speaking with their colleagues over the last 2 weeks because of the tragedy at Champlain Towers South. Let's start by saying hello to Rick Glazer. Rick is with Glazer and Sachs, a condominium law lawyer based here in South Florida. Eric, welcome to the program. The focus on homeowners and homeowner board members in the Champlain Towers South right now, is that appropriate in your estimation?
Well, needless to say, sure that they were tasked with a tremendous amount of work to do. They had to engage engineers. They had to get contractors. They had to do a big package. They had to borrow money. They had to pass special assessments. And they had to do all of this in the middle of the pandemic. Now, the one thing that they weren't told, while they were told that the building needed major repairs, the one thing that any engineer report left out was, if you don't make it, this building is going to collapse. Nobody ever told this board that. So, you know, the reality is it wasn't in any engineer's report because no building has collapsed in the history of buildings.
Eric, would that be something that a board should expect to have in a structural report, that a building will collapse or would collapse?
I can tell you I've never seen that in a construction report. You know, unfortunately, the engineer who wrote that initial report in 2018 is taking a lot of heat right now because his report did not say that the building was going to collapse. And again, he didn't include that in his report because nobody expected this building to collapse. You know, like most boards, they thought that, okay, it's going to take us a little longer to do this project. And if it takes us a little longer, we understand that the concrete's going to deteriorate more, and we'll have to spend more money to fix it. But did anybody think for a moment that the building was going to collapse? Of course not. And that's why several board members actually died in the crash of the building as well.
What is the responsibility of a homeowners association board for the maintenance of their building?
They have a statutory duty. They have a contractual duty. They have a fiduciary duty to make sure that the common elements are kept up to par and remain in good condition at all times and remain safe. course, they have that responsibility to the unit owners.
And as it relates to the Champlain Tower South, reports have been surfaced that the board had been notified of not only deterioration of some of those common elements, but serious and ongoing deterioration of some of these very important structural pieces, not just the paper and painting in hallways and you know, lobbies, but real structural elements of the building that can be out of sight for owners for a good long time unless they're looking for them.
No two ways about it, and that's the expensive stuff, the stuff that's hidden, you know, the concrete restoration. But, you know, just like you said, the parking garage problems, you're right. That's where really the amount of money to make these repairs are seven or eight figures. And guess what? The unit owners simply did not have that money on hand. Why? Because Florida allows the unit owners to waive the funding of a reserve account or a rainy day account, if you want to look at it that way, which this building desperately needed. They were about $10 million underfunded.
Right.
On their reserves, and that's where the problem lies in Florida.
So let's talk about that with the Julio Rabina, former Florida state representative for Miami-Dade County. Julio, welcome to the program. You told NBC News that if a law you helped write in 2008 would have been in effect, quote, this never would have happened, end quote. How can you speak with such certainty?
Well, first of all, good afternoon, and thank you for allowing me to be on this panel. It's cut and dry. It's very clear. My comment is very clear. If we would have had this piece of legislation left alone that was in that bill back in 2008, it would have done what was still not even mandatory today. What would you consider basically a study, an engineering study? It's referred to sometimes as a reserve study. They do a calculation study. So in other words, the building, these buildings every 5 years would have these structural engineers, professionals that would come out and tell them what shape it's in, what's the life expectancy of the capital projects. Remember, this is structural, this is roof, these are pools, elevator, life safety issues, parking lot. They would have a grasp and an understanding of where that building was, and it would have made it easier to understand the need to sock away money in the future. And as our attorney, Mr. Glazer, has explained, it's sad that it's not mandatory to have some type of reserve, because at least they would have had more money than what they had in place, and they could have done and addressed these repairs. So again, why would they remove what I consider to be the number one priority of the citizens of Florida? And I want to share this with you. This was not my idea. I was the chairman of a select committee appointed by the Speaker of the House and the governor of the state of Florida. And I traveled the entire state of Florida, county, normally per county, from Monroe County all the way to Jacksonville and Pensacola. And we had hearings where hundreds of people showed up. Do you know what the number one concern was from owners? These are owners and even board members. Their concern was there's no maintenance being given to our building. We refer to that as deferred maintenance.
Yeah.
What's being done with my money? Where is it going? So when they started talking, and everybody was given 5-10 minutes to speak, and they'd say, we can see our balconies are sagging, we can see rebar, we can see our roof. Common sense drove myself and my committee to add a provision in that statute that said, let's add a 5-year review of this right. building. Common sense, because it wasn't getting done, and it's still not getting done, and it lasted for 2 years.
Yeah,
once I was gone from the legislature, they repealed.
It was repealed in 2010. That legislation that was in effect for 2 years required buildings taller than 3 stories to be inspected every 5 years unless the board waives that inspection. So there was still an element of self-policing here, Julio. There was still that element of, you know, board members may be complaining or owners in a building may complain about problems that they see, that they're experiencing. Windows don't close properly anymore. Door frames are crooked, for instance. But, you know, again, back to the responsibility of the HOA board for the maintenance of the building. Where does that lie, Julio?
Well, and let me jump in on that one, because, again, this would have given them at least a path, information on what to look for, done by professionals, not by volunteers, because, you know, the members of boards in Florida are volunteers. A lot of them don't have any experience at all in anything structural or any type of thing pertaining to what it requires to maintain a building. So they now depend on two people. They depend on the property management company, which is a licensed professional that should be guiding them, and the law firms. I will tell you that here's what bothers me, and I've said this openly. The board members are only as good at times as the course that they took, the little bit that they learned from a course or from reading the statutes, but the people that guide them, if this type of report was still in place, would be the association attorney giving good legal advice and a property management company. And as Mr. Glazer said, their number one responsibility is to maintain the integrity of that building. So what happens? Where was the law firm that should have told them when 2 years ago a report came forward? I don't know. But it's funny, because I'm going to tell you, my life in Tallahassee, a lot of the people that lobbied against this 5-year, structural inspection that I put in my legislation were two groups, not Mr. Glazer, I want to be clear, but there were a lot of law firms, large law firms that lobbied against anything that I did like this. Also, a lot of the large property management companies, under the pretense that this would put an unforeseen financial burden on these buildings, on these owners. And our response to that nonsense: you can't put a price on making sure that building is maintained properly.
Julio, stick with us here. I want to bring in Mary Ellen Klass, reporter for the Capitol Bureau, Capitol Bureau chief, as a matter of fact, for our news partner, the Miami Herald. Mary Ellen, always wonderful to have you on. You covered the legislature back then. You see it now. What role is the state playing in examining this particular HOA board, and more of the general question about accountability for HOA boards?
Thank you for having me on. I think there's a lot of unanswered questions. The Department of Business and Professional Regulation has oversight over condominium associations. They have, I think, a limited role. I think Julio and the people that he has worked with, many of the activists that have been hoping for more oversight, might have a better assessment. It's been very hard to get answers right now. Perhaps they're inundated, but there is a condo ombudsman who is supposed to be the eyes and ears and the voice for individual condo owners. There's a lot of questions about what role they play. There's no doubt in my mind that there will be a lot of focus on many of these issues that that Representative Urbina brought up throughout most of his career, and they didn't get the kind of attention perhaps they should have back when he was working on them. Right now, because of the horrible tragedy at Surfside, we are now watching, as today the Florida Bar convenes a special task force that is looking at how to handle or come up with recommendations for improving oversight, either by rule or law. The Florida Engineering Association has come up with their own special working group. We've got insurance companies, realtors, many special interests that are really, you know, that the condo industry in this state are important to. Many of those groups are now clamoring for legislation or a rule change. So we'll see some change.
And a grand jury in Miami-Dade County has been asked to to ask questions about just all of these issues. We're talking about the role of homeowners associations, condominium owners associations. Mary Ellen Klass is the Capitol Bureau chief with our news partner, the Miami Herald in Tallahassee. Julio Urbina is a former Florida state representative for Miami-Dade County. Eric Glazer is also with us. Eric is with Glazer and Sachs, a condominium law lawyer based here in South Florida. 305-995-1800, 800 number, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Lobo in Key Biscayne wants to tell us the perspective of being a board member on one of these associations. Lobo, thanks for calling. You're on the radio.
Good afternoon, and thank you for having me. Yes, I've been on the board for, I think it's something like 10 years now, 11 years. Got in there because the previous board had not been following up for the 40-year certification. Mm. We were about to be condemned. So, you know, that's why I got in there. And ever since, the five of us have never faced any challenge. Nobody wants the job. Let's start with that. Nobody wants the job. Second, the biggest problem that I found, especially, you know, during the 40-year certification and the surprises that popped up, you know, this building was made in 1973. There was practically no regulation back then. It's a three-story building, so structurally, I think we're okay, but electrically and things like that, I mean, it was Pandora's box. The first assessment that we had for that, we had to double it because of the electrical situation that we found. And here comes the problem. It's absentee owners, because the people who live in the building, they see the problem. They don't want to fix it. You know, they don't want to spend the money, but they know they have to. And that's it, you know, and it's bad enough like that. But when you have absentee owners who don't live here, who don't come here, who just collect the rent, and they really, quite frankly, don't give a damn about
it. Careful, yeah. Lobo, yeah. We get, thanks for censoring yourself, but we certainly get to where you're going. You mentioned you've been on the board for 10 years, beginning with that 40-year certification. The 50-year is coming up. Have you undergone that?
Exactly. And the thing is that, you know, owners do not, they never show up for any meeting. And then at the last moment, when you have everything done, somebody shows up and they kick the can back to the starting line. And I think that's happened in Champlain Towers, because from what I read, there was 5 board members that resigned back in 2019 precisely because of that reason.
Lobo, you bring up some very important points, though, as a condominium association board member there in Key Biscayne. Lobo, Katia Essen is a board member at the condominium building Shore Apartments. That's on Miami Beach's Normandy Isles, just about a mile or so away from the Surfside collapse. That building is a lot smaller than the Champlain Towers South. Her building, only 3 stories. It was built in 1948 and is more than a year behind its recertification inspection. This week, she told WLRN's Daniel Rivero that there's just a lot of work that was ignored by previous condominium boards.
And here we are, laymen and women who are like need to like now become specialists about electricity, about elevators, about roofing.
Echoing exactly what Lobo and Key Biscayne was talking about, amateurs, homeowners who are tasked with making some pretty complex decisions occasionally, and sometimes tasked with making those decisions quickly.
Things go so slow that I can understand why things took so long. So there's something wrong, you know, for me in the system.
We're talking about Homeowners Association and the role here that they play in the maintenance and safety of buildings. Eric Glazer is a condominium law lawyer based here in South Florida. Eric, you heard from Lobo and Key Biscayne. You heard from Katia there on Normandy Isle about volunteering for these boards. What kind of training is required? What kind of training could be required to serve on an association?
Well, I'm glad you asked me, quite frankly, because Julio kind of touched on it. I lead the league in certifying directors to become certified by the state of Florida to actually serve on a board. In other words, I teach a class around the state. It's like a 3-hour class. They learn so much in a 3-hour class, and you need to get certified within 90 days of getting on the board, or you're automatically off the board. The problem with the state of Florida is they give the board member a choice. Do you want to get certified by taking a class, or do you want to get certified by signing a paper, literally, that says, I've read my governing documents and I promise to enforce them? So believe it or not, you can get certified simply by signing that silly, self-serving, stupid form rather than having to attend a 3-hour class. I've been fighting hard to make it mandatory to attend that class.
Yeah, Eric, Julio wants to get in. Go ahead.
And let me jump in on that. I was the one who established in legislation for the first time ever some type of class, of something where these board members had knowledge. And Eric's been doing an incredible job within the current law to train people. But 3 hours, you know, is not enough to take a volunteer and teach them this. Let me tell you the background. So I wanted a full course. I did want people to have to take a full course, maybe a weekend course like a CAM's got to do to really understand the role. It was overturned by the special interest groups. They were the ones that said during the amendment process of legislation, oh, well, let's give them an out. Let's go ahead and say if they read the statutes and sign an affidavit, that justifies. That is politics, and the reason they said they did that was because, oh, well, if you make it this hard, nobody will ever want to be a volunteer board member. That was the excuse, but look at the price we pay.
Mary Ellen, let me ask you about the legislative conversation that has been initiated because of this tragedy, and a lot of focus has been around inspections and notifications and recertifications. What about any legislative focus on just the training of board members?
I have not seen, I'm not up to speed on any new legislation as it, and maybe Eric could answer that.
Well, I can certainly say this. Since Mr. Robina left the legislature, there has been nobody, and I mean nobody, who remotely took his place and championed the rights of unit owners. As a matter of fact, we all know that from going forward, unit owners should not be allowed to completely waive the funding of reserves. That's giving them enough rope to hang themselves with. But you know who's going to fight it the most? Attorneys who represent developers. Because when the maintenance is more, it's harder to sell units. Mm-hmm. That's all the legislature cares about, giving developers the ability to sell units.
All right, let's squeeze in some more calls here from folks. Peter is joining us from Miami. Go ahead, Peter. Thanks for calling.
Good afternoon. Fantastic conversation. I want to thank Representative Robina. I remember when he did it way back when. I used to be on a condo board. I served for 3 years over in Miami Beach, a building very similar to the one that went down in terms of the structure. We dealt with some of these issues. So what Representative Robina was doing at the time was really sort of critical. But the question I have, and there's a lot of blame to go around, is 10 to 12 years ago, there were two buildings that were shut down, one in Miami Beach, another one in Brickell Avenue. The Brickell Avenue one, I think, was called the Brickell Yacht Club, right at 15th and Brickell Bay Road, if you will. And then the one on Miami Beach was called Castle Beach. City went in there, they shut everybody, they shut the building down, they made everybody leave. Where was the city or cities this time? And did the Surfside municipality versus the Miami Beach municipality, did that factor in? Or were the inspectors just simply busy doing something else?
Let me jump in because I have the answer to that question. This is Representative Robina. I dealt with that Castle Beach situation, horrible situation. As you know, several inspectors for the city of Miami Beach were fired. And because of that case, apparently they falsified inspections. But what that building was, that used to be a hotel, and that was a condo conversion. And what happened there was that the developer who was converting it into a condo, here it is, listen to this, you're not going to believe this. The bottom line is that used to be a hotel with little refrigerators, not much needed in the form of electrical work done. But then again, when they went ahead and built the building, they didn't make the upgrades in the wiring, now thinking that these are going to be full condos with a range, a refrigerator, a dishwasher. So what happened was they didn't make the proper electrical upgrades. Somehow or another, they signed off on that. What happens, luckily for them, the people started to buy and move in slowly, but the circuit breaker started to trip. Mm-hmm. Where am I going with this, to be brief? That could have turned into an inferno. That whole building could have burned. Unfortunately, the people that bought for 2 years, these poor people, that not poor in money, but poor individuals that made a bad decision buying there, were removed from the building for several years, still had to pay for their maintenance, still had to pay for the, they still had to pay maintenance, they still had to pay their property taxes, still had to pay whatever it was. Plus, they were removed for several years and had to find housing somewhere else. That was a fiasco with that particular condo conversion.
Mary Ellen, finally, I just want to give you a moment here to talk a little bit about process, because it's I think it's an important piece here in terms of the timeline. The legislators are not in session, right? There's not a law writing session that's due to be on the books, on the calendar for many, many months. But there's talk, obviously, about some kind of legislative response. What does that timeline, that process look like?
Well, the legislature is going to be returning here for committee meetings in the fall, October. They'll be back in session in January. That should be enough time for these various groups to ramp up their recommendations. The question I have is whether this will get the same response that the last time we had this kind of focus on our building code was Hurricane Andrew. Mm-hmm. And at that time, the legislature was reluctant to impose stricter standards statewide. They limited the initial strict standards to just South Florida, as if the wind affected that part of the state differently. I just wonder whether this legislature will be willing to impose requirements statewide, specifically for coastal communities. I think there's going to be a lot of resistance. I think there is also going to be a lot of attention to some of these, you know, reserve requirements and increased inspection requirements. But the bottom line is it will cost more for homeowners, and that's where the reluctance will continue to be.
Very good point.
Mary Ellen Klass, the Capital Bureau Chief at our news in Tallahassee with our news partner, the Miami Herald. Mary Ellen, thanks for sharing all your reporting expertise with us.
Thank you.
Julio Urbina, former Florida state representative and condominium law reform advocate. Representative, thanks for your time and sharing your experience as well.
Appreciate it, sir. Thank you.
Eric Glazer with Glazer & Sachs, condominium law lawyer based here in South Florida. Eric, your perspective, very important. Thanks for sharing it with us.
Thank you for having me.
We've got more to come here on the South Florida Roundup, the latest on a North Miami Beach building that was evacuated just a week ago over structural worries. The mayor of that community will join us next. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. Today, this Friday, is the first day in a week that residents of Crestview Towers and North Miami Beach have been able to return to their homes, but they cannot stay. They have only 15 minutes to gather some personal items. A week ago, the building was evacuated. Maria Rodriguez is among the 300 people who called Crestview home.
Lo material para nosotros es importante. Somos una familia de cinco. Solo trabaja por ahora mi esposo. Tengo una bebé de tres meses.
Rodriguez said right now her husband is the only one working to support the family of five. The family is living in a hotel room. She needs a crib for her three-month-old baby. Inspections at the building revealed electrical and structural repairs are needed at this nearly 50-year-old condominium complex. The city has been working with the county agency, the Homeless Trust, trying to find accommodations for the residents now displaced. On Thursday, Homeless Trust Chairman Ron Book said the agency is housing 55 people, six dogs, three cats from that building, but more resources are needed.
I found eight more families that had been living in cars, everyone but two, with little children, and the two that didn't were taking care of elderly, infirm family members.
Now, meantime, the North Miami Beach Police Department has launched an investigation into the current and past condominium associations of the Crestview Towers. During a press conference Thursday, Police Chief Richard Rand said they're reviewing financial records and reports submitted by residents.
What happened in Surfside is an absolutely horrific event, and I don't want to see that happen in the city of North Miami Beach. We're becoming very proactive to make sure that these associations are doing what they're supposed to be doing. The only thing we need help with is sometimes we don't know.
Anthony DeFilippo is with us now, the mayor of North Miami Beach. Mr. Mayor, welcome to the program. Thanks for your time.
Good afternoon. Thank you, sir.
A structural review of this building on Saturday last weekend concluded that the integrity is in fair condition. Why can't residents move back to their homes?
It's very simple. Fair condition does not meet the requirement of people moving into their homes. This building As for the report that was given to the city, it was actually created on January 11th, 2021. It was submitted to the city of North Miami Beach on July 2nd.
Right. This was the original review of structural integrity and electrical problems that led to the evacuation of Crestview Towers a week ago on this Friday. A day later, the association gave the city, as I understand it, another review that found that the structural integrity was in fair condition.
Correct. And I think you would hopefully agree with me that in one day that they could have not have fixed the laundry list of issues that are in this report. Miami-Dade County Fire and Rescue have over 18 outstanding violations that have not been complied with. They have elevators that are not functioning in that building. There are health and safety issues that currently exist that have not been resolved. First and foremost, we don't want to displace anybody from their homes. As most people know, and I'm a community association manager licensed by the state of Florida, 40 and 50 year inspections are done with people living in buildings. Mm-hmm. However, the neglect and the abuse of this association of not acting the way they should have in a timely manner has now brought this association and all of the residents and owners to their knees. There is no reason why this should have waited this long to be addressed and these issues gone unattended with people paying their monthly maintenance in that building.
The building is 9 years behind that recertification. Does the city bear any accountability for allowing a property in its jurisdiction to fall so far behind in a mandated recertification?
No, at this point, legally, our lawyers are dealing with the situation together with our building department. They had asked for certain extensions. We had worked with them. They never pulled any permits, which is what really caught my eye and was bothersome to me. But the fact that at the beginning of the year, the report was turned in and that report didn't come in till the second, you know, why was there a lapse in six months for a report to be turned in? What was being held back? What was being hidden from our building department? Why didn't anybody come forth and give those permits of starting the work that needed to be done? And there's a lot of things that are alarming in these reports.
Yeah, and even beyond just the six-month delay between the time when the association reportedly had that structural report turned in to when it handed it over to the city last week is the 9 years that came before that it didn't have its recertification in place. And you said that the city had been working with the building. What have you learned about that process that allowed 9 years to lapse beyond the point where the recertification had been required?
What I have learned, and I'll be brief because there is an investigation pending, is that they abused of the time that the city gave them to work on this. When this report came in, our administration saw what was going on. We took immediate action right away. We saw that there was documents that were dated back and were not turned in properly. And immediately our city manager, once became aware of this through our building department, put a halt on this. And this is where we are today.
Yeah.
We have all the interests of working with the association, but not putting at stake the lives of the residents and people that live in that building in no way, shape, or form.
So are you saying that the Condominium Association backdated certain documents it was turning into the city?
There was documents that were not turned in or were not turned in a timely manner. And I'll just leave it with that.
A lawyer for the Condominium Owners Association told our news partner, the Miami Herald, the city was not working in good faith with the association. What's your response?
The response is that, you know, lawyers are going to say what lawyers are going to say. At the end of the day, the proof is in writing. The proof is the ink on the paper. And the reports that have come back from the engineers, we can't go just based on the engineers of the building. We also have to go based on our engineering reports, which we honor and respect as well. And, you know, listen, the Miami-Dade Fire and Rescue also have issues. So until these right. issues are met and there's a full walkthrough and we understand that there's the life and safety issues are corrected, the electrical issues are taken care of, the balconies are taken care of, which are corroding and are a danger. There's many, many issues on these reports that still have not been addressed and need to be addressed for this to be a safe. The balcony slabs and concrete joints, there's so many issues. The cracks at the beams and the columns and the sills. You know, folks, ladies and gentlemen, people live in these buildings. We do not. And I applaud Mayor Levine Calva for putting out the recommendation for all cities to review going back what was pending on the books and what was pending on the books when we found this lingering and we took evasive action right away. Because going 10 years out is not a responsible way of carrying out a document and a recertification of this caliber.
And today on this Friday, Mr. Mayor, as you and I are speaking, the 300 or so residents are being allowed back in 15 minutes at a time. What does the timeline look for them about even being able to get back into their homes to retrieve more belongings, in addition to the longer timeline, just that they can return back home?
Well, you hit a good point, because I let me address your first question. The city of North Miami Beach today is allowing all the residents of Crestview Towers to go in and get any medication or personal belongings, jewelry, anything of value, anything that they need. They're welcome to come in from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. today. I have spoken with the city manager, which has in turn communicated with the city attorney. I've also spoken with the chief of police to see if somehow we create a plan next week to allow the people who are living in this building to go in there and gather the rest of their valuables and their belongings and move out. There's no reason why, if there's people that have their belongings and their livelihood and everything they've worked for in there, there's no reason why we should be holding that stuff hostage. If they want to get those things out and go on with their lives and move into another building or move on in somewhere else, then so be it. Let them do so. This process, it doesn't look like it's going to be days. It does not look like it's going to be weeks. So until this is done, I, as mayor, I made the recommendation to the manager to kindly put together a schedule to go ahead and let these residents in on a limited basis, maybe odd and even number of units, maybe number of floors on different days. And those who want to move their stuff out, get their stuff out completely and move on with their lives.
When do you expect that schedule to be public, that you can communicate that with residents?
I'm hoping that our city manager and our staff will have that available by Monday. I also want to give credit and recognition to State Senator Jason Pizzo, who has played a major role in creating even an outline and a spreadsheet and recommendations to the city manager on going about this. As many of you may or may not know, Senator Pizzo did present legislation previously in Tallahassee, and it was not followed through. It was turned down. And it just goes to show the tremendous leadership that he has and knew when to put it in place. I'm hoping that this year, in this legislative session, what Senator Pizzo has brought forward will pass, and people will recognize that this leader knew when it was the right time to pull the trigger and get this legislation in place. And had we done that last session, we wouldn't be where we are today.
Mr. Mayor, let me just our final moments here. Hundreds of residents of your constituents have been displaced with this evacuation. The Homeless Trust is assisting with those. What more can the city of North Miami Beach do to assist those residents of Crestview Towers to find temporary homes immediately, if not something perhaps more permanently, as you mentioned, as this issue with their home stretches into the weeks and months ahead?
We're doing everything we can, Tom. We really are. I thank Ron Book. I thank the Homeless Trust and their organization for helping out. I was there yesterday. A lot of people there displaced. That lady that you were just speaking about.
Yeah. Give us a sense of what additional work the city can be doing, or what you're asking the city to do.
Well, we're trying to provide meals. We're trying to continue to provide for those people that are that were in their cars. I think we got most, if not all of them, under a roof in hotels, and we're going to continue that. My question is, what is the association going to do for these people? Mm-hmm. They're the ones that took these people's money. They're the ones that got to come forth and say what they're going to do it and make it right for the people who they took money from and now have them on the streets. We don't have them on the streets. It was the association's responsibility to take care of these outstanding items for years now, a decade. And you know what? That's irresponsible association management, and the onus is on them, not on the city.
Mr. Mayor, I appreciate your time today. Thanks for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
Anthony DeFilippo is the mayor of North Miami Beach, talking about the Crestview Towers evacuation 1 week ago, as those residents are allowed back into their apartments and condominiums today for 15 minutes to gather some personal belongings. Stick with us. Plenty more to come here on the South Florida Roundup, discussing the assassination this week of the president of Haiti. That's next. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Haitian authorities say they've killed a number of suspects and made several arrests in connection to the assassination of the country's president, Jovenel Moïse. Moïse was killed in his home early Wednesday morning. His wife, Martine Moïse, was wounded and airlifted to Jackson's Ryder Trauma Center in Miami. The attack on the president has left Haiti, a country already fractured by an unstable economy and political environment and rise in criminal violence, stunned, including the diaspora here in South Florida. WLRN America's editor Tim Padgett is with us here on the South Florida Roundup. You were just listening into a news conference here on this Friday, Tim, with some of the latest details regarding the suspects. What can you share with us?
Well, this was a press conference by the Colombian military. As you may know, a lion's share, it seems, of the assassination suspects involved in this commando-style operation that happened 1 a.m. Wednesday were Colombian, and most of them, if not all of them, were retired Colombian soldiers. And the military, this is a very embarrassing situation for Colombia, and the military brass just concluded telling us about how these soldiers, these ex-soldiers, were recruited. Apparently, four security companies in Colombia were involved in recruiting ex-soldiers to do this kind of mercenary work. And they all flew out of Colombia this week on two different flights, one into Port-au-Prince, one over to the Dominican Republic, and then joined the other assassination suspects there and carried out this bizarre operation on Wednesday.
So was this something planned in Colombia by these former soldiers?
We don't know. Here's one interesting thing. As you know, two Haitian Americans from South Florida are also among the arrested. Now, according to a judge in Port-au-Prince who's been interviewing these guys, one of them named James Solage, he apparently told the judge, according to Haiti's largest newspaper, La Nouvelliste, that he had found this job, quote, on the internet. So it just keeps getting more and more bizarre.
Yeah.
And so apparently these guys, whether they were here in the United States or in Colombia or in the Dominican Republic or wherever these guys have been from, they apparently were recruited as mercenaries through different channels, be it a security company or an internet ad, who knows?
With the Colombian authorities talking about this today, was there any connection between the Fort Lauderdale resident, the Solage, and Colombia?
No, not that I heard during the press conference. So that there's a disconnectedness there too that just makes this more mysterious. But the real question is going to be, who were the people inside Haiti? Because yesterday I had a conversation with the U.S. ambassador, the Haitian ambassador to the U.S., Bokshi Edmond, and he told me they are all but certain that this was organized and conspired inside Haiti. This was, quote, an inside job.
Within the country.
Within the country.
Did he share with you any evidence or his thoughts on why he felt so strongly about that?
Only the sort of the extraneous evidence they have. This, for example, these guys were not the smartest bulbs in the drawer, right? These alleged assassins. One of them had on him the car rental contract that they had used from Avis in Haiti to rent the SUVs that they used for this. And so they're using that kind of evidence now to go back, try to find a paper or money trail, and we'll see. But that kind of extraneous evidence is leading them to believe that this was generated inside Haiti.
And that money trail is likely to ultimately, if it has some kind of end, provide some clarity around the financing.
Yes.
For this. I mean, mercenaries, these are literal, with fatal results, guns for hire in this case.
And look at how many guys were involved in this.
More than a dozen we've heard of now.
It could be more than 20 that we're seeing. So you had an enormous amount of mercenaries who were hired, apparently, for this sort of thing. That's a lot of money. And so that's why things are pointing toward, you know, could it have been some, family of the elite, for example, in Haiti behind this, who frankly had been alienated by President Moïse with his policies.
And so let's talk about Haiti leadership going forward here for the Haitians on the island and the diaspora here in South Florida with family members, loved ones, business associates there. Immediately, what is this leadership vacuum being filled with?
Not much. Here's an example. Right now, according to the Constitution, if a president dies, the person who steps up is the prime minister, along with a council of ministers. Well, we can't even get that straight in Haiti right now because the current interim prime minister, Claude Joseph, is being told by the prime minister who was selected by Jovenel Moïse just days ago to be the new prime minister. They're in a clash right now over who should be the acting president. So that's the kind of vacuum we're dealing with.
And is there international diplomacy that can step in to have these sides come to some kind of at least short-term agreement, power sharing, or some other kind of negotiated conclusion that allows some kind of clarity of leadership in Haiti?
I don't see any other way. I think the U.S. and the international community are going to have to step in because it's not that when we talk about the power vacuum, we're also talking about the fact that the Haitian parliament no longer functions. We're talking about the fact that the Supreme Court is in disarray because its chief justice just died. There is a complete institutional void right now in Haiti, and the U.S. and we've already hearing Haiti experts saying that MINUSTA, for example, the U.N. organization that had kept security and stability in Haiti for so many years after the earthquake, has got to step back in. Now, I don't see any other way.
Is there an international appetite for that?
None whatsoever. But again, it's looking more and more imperative.
And is there any internal appetite among Haitians to accept that kind of intervention, for lack of a better word?
I think at this point, a lot of Haitians have just resigned to it because they realize that there's no other way. But again, you have to recognize that after the earthquake, they're so jaded on foreign aid and foreign assistance because it worked out so badly for them after the earthquake. So it's nothing that they really want. But I think if you're a typical Haitian, you're just looking and say, what else can we do except accept this kind of international stabilizing aid
at this point? Then for the diaspora here, they recently got a little bit of clarity regarding temporary protected status and the ability for that to continue for the time being.
Right.
How does this political assassination, in a literal sense, put that back in focus?
Oh, it puts it in very, very clear focus. I think it was, if there's one silver lining to this, it is that President Biden gave Haitians here or renewed their temporary protected status, because it's even more imperative right now that they have that.
But could they change some of the dates arrival?
That's a very good point. It may force the Biden administration to say, you know, we may have to push this up because the date of Moïse's assassination may now be another destabilizing factor in Haiti that we have to take into account when we're giving people TPS.
Tim, I'll let you get back on the reporting here, and I know we'll have more throughout the weekend. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Tim Padgett, WLRN's America's editor here with us, speaking about the situation in Haiti that is fast developing. That'll do it for the South Florida Roundup this week. It is produced by Andrea Perdomo. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Lance Dixon is our digital editor. News director Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. The director of radio operations and the program's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives answers the phones. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, listening, tweeting, and above all, supporting WLRN. Have a great weekend. This program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.